In your own words, how would you define consent?
I suppose, in my own words, consent is basically an agreement between people to engage in sexual activity, but it must be freely given and actively given.
Consent has to be wider than just, you know, a very narrow definition of intimate acts or sexual acts. Consent is more about the individual autonomy of your sexual identity, of your body, of your being, which then translates into the ability to, you know, say yes or no in sexual acts.
It's about that kind of positive, affirmative consent, that it's people having the ability to freely understand and make an active choice to have sex or sexual contact with somebody else.
What do we mean by sexual consent? It turns out that that's quite a difficult question. In this five-part series, we will explore our ideas about consent, where they've come from, and how we tend to use them, particularly in our laws, and how these ideas have evolved both legally and socially. My name is Amrita Alawalia McMedis, and this is The Age of Consent. Last episode, we looked at the history of rape laws, tracing their evolution from medieval times through the Victorian era and up to the modern day. This episode, we will look at perceptions and beliefs around sex, consent, and rape, and the consequences that these can have. We first return to the Maiden Tribute to look at how it illustrates these themes. The Maiden Tribute is perhaps most telling when it comes to middle-class readers' perceptions about the working classes, and the belief that working class girls had very different sexual morals, ones that meant that they were more sexually mature and susceptible to the advances of unscrupulous gentlemen seducers. Stead wrote the Maiden Tribute to uncover the labyrinth of vice that he called the London Underworld. He was a founding member of the National Vigilance Association, an organisation campaigning for public morality. Along with other social reformers, he wanted to bring about changes to law that he believed would protect young working class girls from the dangers of sex, with a particular focus on raising the age of consent. The nature of this focus is telling. There was no provision for an age of consent for boys. This did not feature in Stead's campaigning, nor was it a feature in the laws that followed the Maiden Tribute. This was very much aimed at girls, and it was working class girls in particular who were considered to be at risk of early and harmful sexual encounters. The fears were that it was all too easy to use young working class girls for immoral purposes. There was certainly a fear that once a girl loses her virginity, she risks falling pregnant, or worse, falling into prostitution. Though these fears might seem separate, in the minds of the campaigners, both threatened the upstanding and moral institution of middle-class marriage. Through the Maiden Tribute, Stead succeeded in his endeavour to raise the age of consent to 16, marking a significant social and legal shift, and showing just how impactful perceptions about sex and consent can be. So what is most people's understanding of consent? And does this align with what our laws define it as? And if there are any gaps between our cultural notions and what the law says, what impact, if any, does this have? We first spoke to Andrea Simon, the director of the End Violence Against Women Coalition, an organisation with a UK-wide membership of over 100 women's organisations and expert members working towards eradicating all forms of violence against women and girls.
We specifically campaign for every level of government to adopt better, more joined-up approaches to ending and preventing violence against women and girls. And also we try and challenge the wider cultural and societal attitudes that tolerate and condone this type of abuse.
In 2018, the Coalition conducted a large piece of research on public perceptions of rape that surveyed thousands of British adults. The report sought to explore what people understood as rape and whether their definitions aligned with legal ones.
So it was a piece of research with almost 4,000 survey respondents. And what it was showing is there's a real worry and confusion, both about what rape is and about how much harm rape does. You know, we were really conscious that we were living in this period of enormous change in attitudes towards sexual violence, when more women than ever were reporting rape to the police. At the time, statistics had showed that reports had grown by over 150% over the last 5 years. And also lots of women were coming forward and seeking help from rape support services. And it was coming at a time when there'd been like a huge attention to sort of the Me Too movement, and lots of survivors had been speaking out about their experiences of sexual violence, of rape. And there was constant discussion around sexual assault and what causes it and what we need to do to prevent it. And obviously those discussions are also really prevalent at the moment. But at the same time as there'd been this huge rise in the number of women coming forward and reporting rape to the police, there were also far fewer suspects being charged, and even fewer were ending up in court and ultimately being convicted. We got to look at it in the context of what's going on for rape prosecution. So since 2017, we've witnessed a huge decline in the rate and the volume of rape complaints that progress through the criminal justice system. Recent Home Office figures suggest that rape complainants now only have a 1 in 60 chance of their complaint to the police resulting in a charge, let alone even getting to a conviction. And that's that represents a really unprecedented crisis in the prosecution of rape.
Just as the Maiden Tribute brought these issues to the fore in 1885, the Me Too movement and other forms of activism have put rape and sexual consent back at the forefront of public discussions. The Coalition's report shows that more and more rape survivors are coming forward to report, which suggests important progress. However, in stark contrast to this, fewer and fewer suspects are being charged. What might explain this discrepancy?
The research found that many people couldn't identify rape, and in some cases the public's view wasn't actually matching the law. So for example, a third of people in Britain thought it wasn't usually rape if a woman is pressured into having sex, but there's no physical violence. The majority, 97% of people, believe it's definitely rape and therefore it's definitely illegal if a stranger is forcing themselves on a woman in a park at night. But then that number dropped to just under 90% of people who were sure that it is rape if a man has sex with a woman who is very drunk or asleep. So that was telling us that around 1 in 10 are unsure or think it's usually not rape to have sex with a woman who is asleep or who's too drunk to consent. So that was concerning. And we know that most people are raped by someone they know, and the vast majority of reports are in this acquaintance context. But there is a lot of confusion about this, especially amongst men. And a third of the men that were asked didn't think it could usually be considered rape if the woman had flirted on a date, then changed her mind. And then the same number also believed a woman can't change her mind after sex has started. Concerning sort of findings around rape in marriage and long-term relationships, that was not accepted as a serious offence by many. And almost a quarter of the people asked thought it, in most cases it isn't rape if non-consensual sex occurred within a long-term relationship. Another key finding was that older people, so those over 65, had more troubling attitudes to rape, while younger people tended to have opinions that were more closely aligned to the law. So more than a third of those over 65, we asked, thought in most cases it isn't rape to have non-consenting sex with your wife or your partner. And that dropped to 16% of 18 to 24-year-olds. And over 40% of over 65s generally thought in most cases, if a woman changes her mind halfway through, but the sex continues, it isn't rape, compared with just around 20% of the 25 to 49-year-olds.
The report also found that people's perceptions of how harmful rape is depends on who is making the allegation. For example, many people assumed that someone who has had more previous sexual partners would be less harmed if they were raped. Likewise, people believed that anyone working as a prostitute would also be less harmed. It seems that while our laws might have changed since the late Victorian era, some of our cultural narratives around who we see as a believable rape victim haven't changed quite as much.
As well as this report that we did on attitudes to sexual consent, We also published a short report on public attitudes to sexual ethics and behaviour in 2018 called Let's Talk About Sex. And it was really interesting as it examined the sexism and stereotypes that society holds around sexual practice. And some of the key findings of that report were that a third of people believed that men need sex more than women. And over 40% of people believed men want sex more than women as well. And most of the findings that came out of that report revealed there was really deep and entrenched sexist ideas about sex. So even after decades of challenging these kinds of ideas and thinking that, you know, most people had moved on from this idea that men need and want sex more than women do, it was showing that large numbers believed that it was still likely that in heterosexual couples, men would initiate, they would orgasm, they would decide when sex is finished, more often than women. But in contrast, women were seen as more likely to just go along with sex to keep their partner happy or to refuse sex and not to enjoy it as much and not to orgasm as much. And this really read as sort of this persistent idea for many people that sex is more for men than women. And why this is sort of interesting and links in is that the sexist ideas around sex that we can identify from research can be a basis for some men developing a sense of greater entitlement to sex and excusing and minimizing of behavior of men around pestering or pushing women for sex. So this combination of ideas that men want or need sex more and women are much more likely to refuse sex creates this toxic idea or status for women as gatekeepers. And that gatekeeper responsibility that women are perceived to have can feed some of the myths and stereotypes that we have about rape. So if women are gatekeepers of where the sex takes place, then they carry more responsibility for sexual interactions that they have. And that means that if, you know, boundaries are overstepped or broken and they experience sexual violence, it's almost like that there is more responsibility on women to have done something to have prevented that. And if you set this kind of against the nature of rape investigations by the police that so routinely turn on a perceived credibility of the woman who's reporting it, so it's principally her that's investigated, it's a really troubling picture where the onus is just routinely placed on the rape victim and not on the suspect. And whilst equality matters just of in itself, and, you know, everyone should have the right to enjoy sort of their sexual relationships and they should be based on, you know, mutual respect and mutual pleasure, it also matters when we think about what is actually happening more widely in society and what's going wrong and why we're failing to deter and to prevent rape.
Rape is still a crime that people have strong views and feelings about. Not only is public perception of rape not aligned with the law, but it also involves social stigma against victims. But what about the experiences and understandings of victims themselves? As members of wider communities, they are negatively impacted by the stereotypes and misunderstandings around rape and rape victims. They may even share some of those biased views, or at the very least, be aware that they are held by many people around them. We spoke to Amrita Dash, who works with rape survivors, to learn more.
Most of the survivors we work with do have quite a lot of internalized shame and guilt, because that's what society has taught us, that if I am assaulted, it is somehow, you know, the person who's assaulted, their responsibility or their fault. So directly working with survivors is one of the ways that we challenge the system that exists.
Amrita works at the Edinburgh Rape Crisis Centre, one of many across the UK whose work focuses on helping victims dismantle these cultural narratives around rape and understand that what has happened to them is not their fault nor their responsibility.
The projects I manage within ERCC are the ERCC's National Advocacy Project, which supports survivors of sexual violence navigate through the criminal justice process. And it can be at any point of interaction within the criminal justice process. So it could be someone who's thinking about reporting, to the police of an experience of sexual violence that they have had. It can be they have reported and they want support post-reporting. It could be for court support and everything in between until someone's criminal justice journey comes to an end at whichever point that might be. And the other project that I lead is called Project Still I Am or Project SEER, which is a specialist counseling support service for Black and minority ethnic survivors in Edinburgh who have experienced sexual violence.
Amrita explains why the reporting process can be very difficult for survivors.
The process of reporting in itself is extremely traumatizing for most people because you have to go through in detail about the trauma. There's also a length of time that is involved in the reporting process and can sometimes can be quite a long time. And there can be, you know, that internalized belief that you hold the honor or this is your shame to carry tends to kind of like come up really strongly, even if one chooses to report. And then there's a lot of questions like, how are the police going to handle this? The concept of honor, that it lies on the woman's shoulders and between their legs, is so deeply entrenched in society in general. However, I believe that how it manifests within different communities is different because of the social consequences that result from this perceived honor being lost or damaged.
To better tailor their support, many organizations offer specialist services that take cultural differences into account and cater to the specific needs of minority and marginalized communities.
3 years ago, it was identified with an Edinburgh Rape Crisis that we didn't see a lot of survivors from Black and minority ethnic communities accessing our counseling support. The numbers were very low. And that was clearly a gap in the service that we were providing to survivors. So we did a bit of exploratory work and it was identified that because of a plethora of reasons, which also include shame and safety and just understanding around what denotes as rape, there might be a lot of hesitancy of accessing Rape Crisis Centre, especially Rape Crisis Centre, which can come across as like very white organization. So we looked at what would be the nature of the support that we are providing. How would we break down multiple barriers that may be present? Language was one of them, accessibility was another. We also looked at the number of sessions because survivors can have multiple experiences of trauma. They can have other experiences such as racism or systemic discrimination that feeds directly into their experiences of trauma and compounds it.
Not only do rape survivors know that they are perceived as responsible for what has happened, but depending on their identity, for example, if they are Black, Asian, or part of another minority ethnic group, they might be less likely to access support, to report, and to be believed when they do. Amrita spoke about how consent can be understood and discussed differently across different communities.
How we understand consent is very, very nuanced in general. Studies have shown that traditionally girls or people from other gender identities who are not cis male have this expectation of having to please their partners or having to be the submissive one quite often and from a quite an early role because we are gendered so early in our lives. When we talk about consent, it's still like sex education and everything in Scotland isn't what it could be. But at the same time, I can tell you from my own experience of working with survivors is that it's not openly discussed in a lot of communities, that you can make decisions about your own body. You can engage in sexual relationship for pleasure, and it is of your own free will. Sex outside of marriage doesn't exist in a lot of communities. So even if we have those conversations, and if I am socialized to believe that I can only have sex in a marriage, I may not tune into those conversations of consent.
Next, we'll be talking to Hannah Bowes about how the stories we tell about sex and rape can have tenacious and far-reaching impacts. Hannah researches criminal law at Durham University. She specializes in violence and abuse and has a particular interest in how these crimes impact older adults.
Most of us get our understanding about violence and abuse, and in particular sort of prevalence and who's victimized, through informal sources. So I think in general, in the public, we rely on the media reporting and to perhaps a lesser extent, some official reports by the government, for example, or by charities or agencies who release papers that talk about the prevalence of these things. And in the case of the media, report on usually high-level sensationalised cases. There are lots of reasons why that is potentially an issue, but for the research that I do and the focus that I have on violence against older women, the main problem with our reliance on those kind of sources is that they are fairly limited. So if I take the classic example of the crime survey for England and Wales, so that is our national crime survey. It used to be the British crime survey. Some people might still think of it as being the British crime survey. It's essentially the same thing. And it's an important survey because, first of all, it's seen as far more reliable than lots of other types of data. So for example, police data is limited to things that have been reported to the police and subsequently recorded by the police. And there are lots of reasons why domestic violence, sexual violence, stalking, and actually other types of crime as well, aren't reported to the police. And there are lots of reasons why sometimes incidents that are reported don't actually end up being recorded as crimes. So the crime survey scene is far more reliable than other sources of data because it simply asks people, have you experienced any of these types of issues or behaviours in the last 12 months? And also, have you experienced any of these in your lifetime, so since the age of 16? And we rely on it in terms of public knowledge. The media will report on the findings of this annual survey. And also we rely on it from a government and sort of legislation and policy perspective, because it tells us nationally what's going on, what trends are like, what prevalence is like in terms of whether it's increasing or decreasing, who is affected by this. So it's a really important source of evidence. And one of the main problems with the crime survey historically, until very recently actually, has been that it has imposed an age cap of 59 on the particular part of the survey that asks about domestic violence, sexual violence and stalking. So what that means is that we've never had any data on the victimisation of people over the age of 60. And so that's a real problem because it means that our public understanding of violence and abuse, which, you know, relies very heavily on what the crime survey says, is automatically not going to tell us anything about violence and abuse against older people. And in doing so, it perhaps indirectly sends the message that this doesn't happen, that, you know, the reason that the headlines don't include older adults is because it's not happening to older adults.
It seems that our narratives around rape are stuck in a vicious cycle. We hold beliefs about rape that don't reflect reality. These beliefs inform how we research and collect information. This research in turn is picked up by media, and biased data tends to be all that the public sees, reinforcing the already warped views about what rape is, who is raped, and by whom. And so this cycle continues.
For me, it's that powerful automatic assumption that violence against older adults can't possibly be the same as violence against younger adults. Yeah, it can't be domestic violence. It can't be sexual abuse. It's just not part of our language or our framing of this issue at all, because we've had these myths and stereotypes, and because we've sort of allowed the issue of violence and abuse against older people to be sort of bracketed off and looked at separately through this elder abuse framework. It reinforces this belief that it is somehow something completely different, that when you're 60, if your partner is physically abusing you, it's elder abuse, it's not domestic violence, purely on the basis of age and nothing else. The behaviour is the same, the context is the same, but you're now 60 and not 59, and therefore we label it differently and we see it differently. And part of the reason we do that is because we've never seen older people as legitimate, likely victims of violence and abuse, and particularly for sexual violence. It's because we, our dominant, you know, understandings of sexual violence have been about this biological urge to have sex and your inability to control it, and it's young women who are raped because they are sexually attractive. And, you know, some of the myths that then are generated from that belief is that, you know, if you wear a short skirt, you're asking for it because you're making yourself look more sexy, and rape is a product of sexual desirability and that inability to control those urges, so on and so forth. So all these other myths that don't directly affect older women do actually end up affecting them, because they continue to reinforce this belief, this wrong misbelief that that sexual violence is caused by sexual attractiveness and sexual urges and desires, you know, and men's biological inability to control those. And by separating violence against older people off, you never make the connections, you never see violence across the life course, and we, as a result, we falsely have believed that it drops off a cliff at 59, 60, 65, whatever, that you don't face these risks anymore, that age is essentially a protective factor. And yet it does exist, and the research shows that it does exist, but because it's kind of looked at through this gender neutral framing that really is concerned with age as a condition and age being the reason that you are assaulted, we don't make those connections between our sort of gendered understandings of violence and abuse in younger life. And so it's all of these types of things, really. I think it's so hard. They're all so tangled up with each other that it's very difficult to pinpoint and say why we haven't had these discussions before, or why awareness is so poor, or how it might impact on consent, because it's a combination of all these different ageist and sexist myths and practices that have rendered violence against older women invisible. We do tend to see ageing in very negative ways, particularly for women. So men will often be, ageing will be considered a more positive thing, not exclusively. I think in general, we see ageing as something that's bad, something that we should try and avoid, and something that may happen to all of us, but none of us should be excited about, and none of us would want to embrace. But I think generally with men with ageing, it's accepted that they will probably still have a libido and they will still want to have sex. And sort of as men age, they're seen sometimes as being sort of more attractive, you know, older men attracting younger women as partners, particularly if they hold sort of powerful positions and if they're celebrities or have jobs that carry particular status. So for men, I think they get away a little bit more with the aging process than women do. For women, it's very much that they are seen as asexual once they reach a certain age, that women are no longer sexually attractive, which is by and large why older men look for younger women as partners. And you know, these sorts of things really reinforce this belief that older people don't have sex, in particular older women don't have sex. And that really is part of the problem, because we don't think of them having consensual sex. So if we don't think that's going to happen, then it's even more difficult, I think, for people to get their head around rape, you know, and kind of non-consensual sex happening. And in order to make sense of it, what often happens is that the debate turns to capacity, and it operates as a bit of a shield and a sword, really. So for example, with older women, it might be assumed that they have dementia or issues with capacity, which mean that they either can't remember things properly, or their accounts can't be trusted, or they may be getting confused about what actually happened. So it sometimes can mean that they're less likely to be viewed as credible. Again, we don't know what the impact of this is on the courtroom, but certainly at earlier stages, in terms of how the media reports on these things and how individuals in society tend to talk about rape in later life, it seems to be, you know, really kind of centering on this idea that older women are not really likely to be raped because they're not sexually attractive. So if they are talking about it, they're probably just getting confused. You know, really, they're not particularly credible victims if you're of a certain age, so on and so forth. So I think that's part of the problem, but then it acts as a bit of a shield for older men, because if they are aggressive, if they're violent, if they are committing sexual offences, you'll often see a narrative again in the media and in kind of public discourses where men are talked about in terms of having capacity problems or dementia or Alzheimer's, and the sort of the health condition is blamed for why they are behaving in that way. So you'll hear people say, oh, well, when people get dementia, they do lose their, you know, inhibitions, and they do become like more sexually sort of active and aroused and do inappropriate things, or, you know, make inappropriate gestures or have inappropriate relationships or behaviours or whatever. So it's sort of neutralised and pathologised a little bit. So men almost seem to benefit sometimes from a stigmatisation and assumption that they've got dementia. It acts in a weird way as a bit of a protective shield against them being a perpetrator of sexual violence, whereas conversely, when women report having been raped or sexually assaulted in later life, it's like, well, who would want to rape or sexually assault you? So we find it very hard to believe. And, you know, perhaps you're not lying, but maybe you're just confused, and maybe it's because you've got dementia. Some of the research I did actually involved speaking to some older women who'd been raped in later life. And that came through very powerfully. It was very difficult for them to make sense of what happened to them, because they themselves had internalized these beliefs that sexual violence is something that happens to younger people. And so one of them, for example, one of the women that I interviewed said that she'd always made a big effort to look young, that, you know, she sort of was really proud of and sort of really prided herself on her appearance and wanted to look youthful. And she would frequently be told that she looks at least 10 years younger than, I think she was in her 70s when I interviewed her. And she said, you know, people would often say to me, I look like I'm in my late 50s or 60s. And I've been really proud of that. But now I'm not proud of it, because that's why I was raped. It's because I look much younger, because if he'd known how old I actually am, he wouldn't have wanted to rape me. And so that's, I guess, a powerful example of how damaging these stereotypes are. We know that they have obviously lots of damaging impacts for young people as well. But for older people, there's this almost like additional hurdle, because I think if you're younger, it's less hard for people to accept that you would be raped, because it's sort of, you know, it's widely accepted, as I said, unfortunately, that it's about being young and beautiful and attractive. And even though we know that's not the case, people still believe that. And so it's, you don't have that initial hurdle of trying to persuade somebody that it is even plausible that you would be raped. And I will caveat that a little bit, because obviously there are lots of women who don't conform to what is seen as the sort of ideal beauty standard of what an attractive woman would be. And, you know, so I'm not saying that all women universally won't have a struggle to persuade people that they are rapeable, basically. But for older adults, it's almost like a blanket automatic assumption that you wouldn't be. And so you've even got that first hurdle to convince others, but also probably yourself, that this is actually something that has happened. And I say for one of the women that I interviewed, the only way that she could make sense of it was that it was somehow her fault, because she'd made herself look much younger than she actually was. And so that is why she was raped, because nobody would rape her if they actually knew she was 70.
So since Dead wrote her sensationalist piece about gentlemen seducers and young, vulnerable, corruptible working class girls, our laws have moved on. But our views still hold a lot of baggage from those times. Who is deemed a credible victim is still very much skewed by stereotypes and misperceptions that impact how we talk about rape, how we portray rape in media, how rape victims process what has happened, whether rape gets reported at all, whether it will progress to trial if it is reported, and inevitably, if a case does make it to trial, it impacts what happens in courts.
One of the major issues is the way in which rape cases get to trial and our adversarial system, you know, really turning on that credibility of a victim or survivor. You know, overwhelmingly, women and girls experience this whole criminal justice system very much shaped by, you know, stereotypes and myths and prejudices which relate to race or age or faith or class, socioeconomic background, disability. All of these things, they play a role. And all of those structural inequalities, they are very much determined, though, who gets convicted. You know, certain perpetrators are much more likely to be convicted than others in sexual violence cases. Why suspects are significantly more likely to avoid further investigation, particularly if a victim is from a minoritized background. And offenders are more likely to be prosecuted if they're from a minoritized group. So you can't really separate these structural inequalities from the ability of rape victims to get justice.
In the next episode, we will look at how rape trials tend to unfold in practice and how a perpetrator's guilt or innocence is determined in courts. We will also delve deeper into the concept of credibility and why it is so tied up with sexual consent. For now, let's return to the maiden tribute. While on trial, Stead argued, "I am not here to advocate liberties being taken with the children of anyone, least of all the children of the poor, but you must sometimes take risks in order to save poor girls from ruin. I believed that in doing as I did with Eliza Armstrong, I was standing between her and ruin." Stead clearly saw himself as an advocate for women's rights. Yet the maiden tribute is an uncomfortable read from a modern feminist perspective. It was motivated by deep sexist and classist beliefs, and triggered significant changes both in terms of law and in terms of social perceptions. But the new laws now drew a clear line in the sand. Girls under 16 no longer had capacity to consent to sex, regardless of how promiscuous and morally corruptible they might be. But was this line always so clear? In practice, did the new laws serve to protect underage girls? We'll explore this in the next episode. This has been the second episode of The Age of Consent, a podcast by Narrative Matters, written and produced by me, Amrita Alawalia McMedis, and Gabrielle Blackburn. We would like to thank Andrea Simon, Amrita Dash, and Hannah Bowes for taking part in these interviews. This series was commissioned by Dr. Laura Lemers-Nyemi as part of a project funded by the Leverhulme Trust. The music in this episode is the Victorian Music Box Lullaby Song by INLPL. To access support, you can call the National Rape Crisis Helpline at 0808 802 9999.